I'd like to welcome Shippo and the three speakers, which is Jennifer Bettsrath, Molly
Donoghue,
and David
Weston
Davey.
Yes, right, yeah.
Sorry, yeah. So before we start the event, I'd just like to do some quick housekeeping to be able to say thank you to all the people that come together to make this actually possible, which there are a lot of people. We have a full heritage working group of 15 people, and for this event we were actually began to work since October, right, Paul? So when we started to...
I think that was before then.
Before then. We held a presentation in September, and that presentation generated a huge amount of questions that people had. And so a lot of the sort of issues were coming up. Questions were quite complex. And so that's when we outreached back again. We've been working with Jennifer Bettsrath for a couple of years now through the survey. Which I'm sure you've all seen the survey, the three-volume survey that's available also in print form at the library and the village. And we assessed 425 buildings. And then that gave us the platform to move forward for the evaluation for the historic district and whether it was going to be eligible for nomination, which brings us, you know, to this. So that September meeting threw up these questions, and we asked Jennifer, and she said, okay, it's time for the agency, the experts, to come in because, you know, the questions are quite complex. And then Paul, I'd like to say an absolute thank you to Paul Napasak.
Well, it's
good. It's good enough, right? Haven't quite got that accent yet done. Who we worked really hard on those questions, those questions and answers flyers, and it went through many, many revisions. Jennifer Bettsworth looked at them too, and Paul and we basically worked for 3-4 months to get that question and answer sheet done, which was mailed out to all the property owners about 2 weeks ago. So I'm hoping that many of the property owners did actually open the mailer, did actually see them. So with that, and just a thank you to the Village of Philmont for allowing us to use the hall again, and thank you to the Village of Philmont for being a partner agency on working with us to move forward to see if the historic district is going to make it through the nomination. So with that, I'd like to hand over and thank Jennifer and her team a lot for coming down. Thank you very much. Get this pulled up.
Everything turns blue. All right, technology. So thank you all for coming out tonight. It's a surprisingly sunny, beautiful evening, especially after all that snow. So appreciate you making the time. We're all busy and you're here. I'm Jennifer Bettsrath. I work in the Survey and National Register Unit at the State Historic Preservation Office. Again, my colleagues Molly and Weston are also here to talk a little bit later about tax credits and code. I will sort of start by giving a broad overview of our agency, the National Register Program, and the implications of listing on the state and national registers. So, a bit cut off there, but we all work for the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. You're probably most familiar with the state parks that our agency manages across the state, and of course, Niagara Falls, you see there, is New York's first state park. And really, it's the first, one of the first state parks in the country. So as an agency, we have been around for a long time. Thank you. And within the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, we represent the State Historic Preservation Office. Every state has one, and within the State Historic Preservation Office, we have staff that help communities identify historic places through cultural resource surveys, provide technical assistance on historic buildings, work with grants and incentives, protect historic buildings under preservation law, and collaborate with communities and organizations to help them achieve their local preservation goals. We're talking about the National Register of Historic Places tonight, and the official definition is that it's the list of historic properties recognized as significant in American history, architecture, archaeology, engineering, or culture. In New York, we're special in that we also have a state register of historic places that was created in 1980. That's actually pretty rare. Not a lot of states have that. And I'm a historian, I can't resist giving you a little bit of history about why we have a National Register in the first place. It was created as part of the National Historic Preservation Act in 1966. And that act really came about, if you think back to the mid-20th century and what's going on, large government projects across the country. We have a classic one right in Albany, where the state of New York took 98 acres of neighborhoods to build a government complex, and there was no way for the people living in those neighborhoods to speak back to the government. There's also many, many examples of roads being run right through neighborhoods, and those communities had no opportunity to have a voice in that. So the National Historic Preservation Act gives us all a way to protect historic resources from the government, really not from their owners. That's where that is coming from, the idea when this is created. And in New York, we give a State Historic Preservation Act that's created in 1980. Again, somewhat rare. Under both of those laws, our office does do some environmental reviews. So if somebody is using that state money or that state permit to do something, it gives historic preservation a seat at the table in those big projects. So if there's a road widening project happening in the middle of a historic district, then we get to say, hey, maybe let's consider the fact that this is a historic district as we work through this project. So it doesn't mean that preservation always wins, just that there's a seat at the table in the conversation. New York State leads the nation in listings on the National Register of Historic Places. We passed 6,000 properties a few years ago. In Columbia County, we have 146 listings. 20 of those are historic districts. So that represents hundreds of properties that are listed here in Columbia County. Resources can be listed on the National Register in one of four areas. So for patterns of history or significant events, significant person, like good old John Brown there, for their architecture or for their archaeological significance. And they can be of local, state, or national importance. And so they range from everything from the Guggenheim to the Big Duck. There's a whole lot of different kinds of things that are on the registers. Some things that are listed on the National Register nearby, the Taconic Parkway, lots of private homes like the 18th century Cornelius Muller House. I understand the basement was used as a prison for some soldiers during the Revolutionary War. Commercial buildings like the Crandall Theater, and then that's the historic district in Hudson. So this is all part of the landscape we live in. So we're here to talk about a proposed historic district. What is a historic district? It's a group of buildings, structures, and sites that are significant for their historical and physical relationships to each other. So buildings in a historic district are not usually individually important, but they're important because of what they can say together about the history of a community or a place. And a district can include any number of properties, so it could be an entire municipality, it could be a neighborhood, it could be a church complex. So when we're studying potential historic districts, one of the things we look at are the boundaries. And boundaries are drawn based on the history of the community, the neighborhood, and a study of the current architectural integrity and the physical setting of the area. So this is what it always comes down to. What does it mean to be in a National Register Historic District? The most important thing to know and understand is that listing in the National Register does not restrict a property owner's ability to remodel, alter, paint, manage, subdivide, sell, or even demolish a building. I have people call me all the time and they say, you know, you can paint it pink with purple polka dots. Really, this comes back to that idea of when the Historic Preservation Act is created, they're thinking about protecting buildings from the government. They're not thinking about protecting buildings from their owner. And so that flows all the way down to what the National Register is and does. The National Register is also not a local historic district. So people are familiar with these. They think of maybe Landmarks Preservation Commission in New York City. I know Hudson has a local historic district. And in those cases, there's a local commission where you have to ask for permission to do something to your building. That's not what the National Register is. You do not have to ask us to do anything to your building if it's listed on the National Register. And I know there's no local preservation commission here, and if you wanted one, that's a local question entirely. It's not something that we would be involved in. And there are things that are locally designated and on the National Register, or locally designated and not on the National Register. So there's all sorts of combinations, and they just because you have one doesn't mean you have to have the other. So National Register designation is an excellent way to honor a community's history, sort of that soft intangible of recognizing that we do have a history in this place, and we are sort of important. Sometimes we forget when we live and work in the same place every day. We forget our history, and designation is a nice way to pause and remember that and record it. Designation also provides private owners access to state and federal tax credits. It provides nonprofit and municipal owners access to state grants, as well as grants provided by nonprofits. And in general, it helps promote the appreciation of historic resources across the state. And here is where I will turn it over to Molly. Thank you.
So, hello, I'm Molly Donahue. I work on the grants unit as well as historic homeownership tax credits. But looking at grants, there are several different grants available. State grants are available from the Environmental Protection Fund. So they're available to municipalities and nonprofit organizations that have an ownership interest in a property that is listed on the state or national register. And then these grants can be used to improve, protect, preserve. A lot of physical preservation work is done with these. And they can also be used to acquire historic properties. So again, these are for nonprofits and municipalities, but it's an advantage that comes along with being listed on the register. Looking at what is usually a popular part of this presentation is tax credit programs. So there are two administered by New York State Historic Preservation Office. The first is the one that I'm a reviewer for, and that's the New York State Historic Homeownership Rehabilitation Tax Credit. So a few things to know about this. It's a 20% tax credit on the cost of your rehabilitation for your home. It can go up to $50,000 of tax credit, so that is effectively a project that is up to $250,000 worth of qualified work. That is per year. You can apply every year for this if you would like. That's a dollar-for-dollar tax credit applied to your New York State income tax. So you do need to file in New York State. You need to be doing that. And it's not applied to either your federal or local taxes. In order to qualify for the program, you need to spend at least $5,000 on your project, and at least 5% of whatever your project ends up being needs to be exterior work. It's currently been approved through December 2024, and we like to note that there is no reason to believe it won't be extended for a longer period, but as long as you get your Part 1 and Part 2, which I'll go over, in before the end of this date, so at the end of 2024, you'll be grandfathered into the program. And then finally, your building must be located in a state or national register of historic places, so that's an advantage of being on the register, and it has to be located in a qualified census tract, which...
The whole district is in a qualified census tract here.
Yes. So, looking at the basics of this program, it's...
I'm sorry, can I interrupt?
Yes, absolutely.
What is a qualified census tract? So, the way the legislation was passed, it's census tracts that are at or below median income for the state. And that is based off of the American Community Survey census data that comes out, I believe, every 5 years. So the places where I work down in Long Island, a lot of them don't get to take advantage of this program. But up here, you guys are good.
And the census tracts are just...
Okay, so anything in Columbia County would be deemed...
If there's a specific area you're interested in, you can talk to one of us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the census tracts were just updated, so the current ones are good through 2027.
Mm-hmm.
So a few basics about the program. This is actually a tax and finance program. We administer the technical aspects of it. So you do, it's the relevant law is Tax Section 606, and that has all the, you know, official language in it. What we do is the technical aspect, and there's a three-part application. You do part one and two together, and then part three is at the end of the project when everything is done. You have to file a New York State tax form in order to do that. So that is a separate form that you would file with your New York State taxes. And you claim the credit at the end of your project. So whenever you finish this out and put in your Part 3 application is the tax year in which you get that credit. Some more basics. The applications do need to be submitted and approved before the work has begun. This is an order for us to, you know, sign off on everything. If we have any comments or suggestions, we can give that before you're in the middle of a project. And it doesn't, we don't cover work that is already completed. If you do have an emergency, we see this sometimes, you know, places flood, roofs collapse in. Talk to one of us. You can always give us a call. We're very happy to chat with people about emergency work. And we do have a little bit of leeway, especially if it's an emergency situation. Hard copy applications, which you still can send in, must have an original signature on them. We also now have digital submissions of these applications, and we're really encouraging people to do that. It's usually a quicker process and reduces paperwork for everybody. And there are associated application fees. Part one and two is always $25 to submit that fee. And then part three is on a schedule. So it goes from $25 up to $475 for $200,000 projects and above. And the other thing to note is that our reviews can take 30 days. So that is the amount of time that we always allow for it. Typically, with the digital submissions especially, that's been quicker, but it can take up to a month. Finally, looking at the type of work that qualifies, it's a lot. So structural systems, including your foundations, roofs, floor joists, ceilings, attics, anything like that is all qualified. Roofs, including coverings, soffits, gutters, every aspect of that. Exterior walls, including bricks, wood, stone repair, paint, cornices, everything there. More work that qualifies are porches, stoops, window rehab or replacement, masonry work, a lot of interior work counts as well, including floors, walls, ceilings, trim, paint, and all of your mechanical systems. So heating, ventilation, electric, plumbing, insulation, weatherproofing, and even solar, which I'll go over in a minute. The thing also to remember with this is we're not asking you to keep your house historical necessarily. Kitchen upgrades, bathroom upgrades, we're not going to hold you to a specific time period. You know, we're not asking you to restore this to a 1900s house. It is mostly about protecting the historical resource that you have. If we look at some work that, so solar panels is a big one that we've seen recently. Any solar panel that's not on a visible elevation, so if you're walking the street, you shouldn't be able to see a solar panel. You are very welcome to put them on your house, but they won't be covered by the program typically. If you have any questions about that, any partial visibility questions, feel free to reach out to us and we can look over your plans. And it really is the whole solar system that we've been covering, that we've been seeing. So your modules, your arrays, your panels, any sort of the electrical systems that go inside your house, those all count.
If I could add, we get a lot of these where solar companies have become savvy to the fact that if something's in a historic district, they can stack the solar credit and the historic credit, and it's been a very popular use of the program.
Yes.
Do when you submit the application, do you have a list of approved companies, workers? Do they have to be?
Okay. So we can't recommend specific manufacturers or companies to work with. I think the Preservation League of New York will occasionally direct you to people, but
in general,
right, so basically, I'm saying you can employ anybody to do the test.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Question. You said the maximum is $50,000. Is that per property or per year?
That is per project per year. So when you open up a Part 1 and 2 application, that's considered a project. So that is $50,000 of credit, so up to $250,000 project. You can do a much bigger project. That's just where the credit's going to cap out on your New York State taxes.
The credit is 50, not the project. Okay,
yes.
So the project would be, $250. And let's say the next year you only did 50, mm-hmm. but the next year you want to add another $50,000 into a project put on the same property, would that qualify?
Yep. You can do the tax credit every year for your property over and over again. You can also, you don't have to close out a project all in one year. As long as you open up a project, you can keep that open as long as you would like. We have an amendment process, so if you want to add any work on, you can do that. But you can also always close it out and then open up a new application.
But you don't get the credit until you close it, right?
Right, exactly.
And you can, if you did a project every year and you accumulated more credit than you can use, it just builds up. It never expires. So it'll just roll over from year to year until you use it all.
Yes. Yes, so exactly. If you...
You said a minimum of 5% for the exterior. Is there a maximum?
Nope. You can do an entirely exterior project. You just can't do an entirely interior project.
I see.
Another thing to note about the credit is if you make $60,000 or below, or that's what you're filing on your New York State taxes, it is taken as a refund instead of a credit. If you file for $60,000 income or above, it'll come as a credit. And if you don't owe your maximum credit back, it will roll over into the next year until you sort of finish it out.
Yeah, another question
yep.
on solar.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have existing solar panels and it doesn't meet your criteria, do they have to be removed if you want to be participating in the program?
Nope. So you mean if you were to start a new project and apply?
On a house that already has solar panels.
Yep. The current state of the house really does not affect what projects you can do going forward. And this is an incentive program, so, we're not going around checking anybody's houses, anything like that. You can opt in entirely, and we're never going to tell you you can't do something to your house. If it's something the program doesn't cover, you won't be able to receive a tax credit for it.
And is there any negotiating involved in if it's new solar panels? typical houses in Philmont have roofs that will be visible from the street.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's also the ideal orientation for the solar panel.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any negotiation there at all?
So typically on a pitched roof, where it's south-facing, so most solar companies will tell you, yes, this is the ideal placement for an array. If it is just completely on the front of the house facing the public road, that's typically not something we would cover. We're always willing to have a conversation about it and sort of explain our thinking on that as well. But you can also look into other orientations. Again, sometimes there's just going to be, that's going to be the best way to get the most out of your solar. And in that case, it would probably not qualify, but you can always get the solar credits back as well.
So the solar won't qualify, but you're not disqualified for everything else you're doing.
Exactly.
Correct. Okay. Right. You just wouldn't get the credit for that particular part. Same like if it was some other kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. So if you submit anything on an application that we don't cover, but otherwise it's a great application, we'll approve everything that we can. And we're not going to make you apply again. We'll probably just give you a call or an email and just say, this is not qualified, but here's all the other items that are.
Can you go over again? Your tax debt is less than the credit you're getting, it becomes a refund.
No, only if your filed income with New York State is $60,000 or below. That's when you'll receive it as a refund. So it has to do with how you are filing. Above that, it will come back as a credit.
But you said you could roll over the credit.
Yes.
So if you can't use it all this year, you can use it.
You can apply it on future years, yes. Mm-hmm.
Could you put solar panels on a garage?
Yep.
And you have a historic house?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be covered?
Yep.
I did that at my house. The solar panels are on my carriage house, a National Register listed house. Can't see them from the street.
Oh, but credit works great. So you can put it on a garage, but it still can't be seen from the street.
Yes.
In that case, I don't know if it would have been an issue otherwise. Because of it being an outbuilding.
Yeah.
I've heard of people putting them in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
They're still connected to the house.
Right.
And that could work.
Mm-hmm. And we find on backyard sheds, if that's your southern orientation, that can work really well with solar, and oftentimes they're not visible from the road. So. Mm-hmm.
Does that go also for air-to-air heat pumps that systems visible from the street?
Generally, yes. Mm-hmm. Typical work that doesn't qualify. So a good way to think about it is if you were to take your house, turn it upside down, shake it, anything that would come out is probably not going to be qualified. It's anything that's a permanent change to the house that even when you sell it or leave will stay with it. So this does include appliances, so any sort of kitchen appliances. Any work outside of the building footprint also usually does not qualify. If it has to do with drainage and foundation, we will consider it. Again, that's considered impactful work on the historic property itself. But any sort of landscaping, paving, or fencing work is not qualified under the program. And then generally, work that is not meeting the Secretary of the Interior standards, which is the guidance we use. So generally, that is going to be a lot of vinyl siding, vinyl windows, and that's replacement. So if you have a house with wooden siding and you want to put vinyl on, we won't be able to qualify that for the program. But otherwise, most work that's being done on historic houses is, you know, if you're matching it like for like, keeping it in good keeping, a lot of that work is generally going to apply.
So you're saying that if you have vinyl siding now, you could actually replace vinyl siding and still get a credit?
There have been cases where it matters what the state of the house is now. Basically. So when we say we're not going to make you restore it to a past state, we mean that. If you have vinyl siding, we're not going to make you put on wood siding. It really is what it is like now.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have to have a contractor do all the work, or if you do the work yourself, can you get a credit for supplies?
Yes. So if you do the work yourself, you can't claim the labor costs, but you can claim all materials. Yeah. And then, so that's the end of homeowner tax credits, and now I'll hand you over to Weston for income producing.
Hello, my name is Weston Davey. I'm in the technical service unit at the State Preservation Office, and I handle reviews of work on buildings that involve state or federal funding and permitting, back to that sort of 1966 Preservation Act law. That's sort of what we call compliance review. And I also review projects for the commercial or income producing historic tax credit program. And I, by review, I mean, I look at the plans and specifications and all the things like that of a building and photos, and to make sure that the work meets the standards for preservation, or in this case, the rehabilitation standards. And I'm going to talk about the tax credit. I'm also going to talk a little bit about code in historic buildings and a bit about energy efficiency in about 10 minutes. So it's kind of a big task in a short amount of time, but I'll do my just boiled the tax credit kind of down to a couple of slides. This one's very bright, but let me go back to the other one actually before I blind everybody with that white background. The commercial tax credit, it's called, is essentially for substantial rehabilitations of historic buildings that are going to be income producing. That could be a rental house. It could still be residential. It just would be rental. This the background photo, Harmony Mills in Cohoes was a huge industrial site that was converted into housing, taking advantage of the tax credit. And so there, it's a federal program, essentially, but it includes sort of equivalent state credit. Once you get the federal, you can take that state credit of 20%, or in some cases, it's been bumped up to 30% for projects that are below a certain total expenditure amount. So potential up to 40, 50% of your investment taken in preservation tax credits. Back to the bright slide. So, yeah, commercial or income-producing historic preservation tax credit. There's a minimum expenditure threshold that's essentially geared toward, you know, the idea of the program is to help out those buildings that need a lot of work to get them up and running. That otherwise might not have been rehabilitated, would have sat there empty. Greater of 5,000 or the building's adjusted basis is essentially the value of the building on its own. And that's something that we don't deal with any of those financial aspects of that. That's something that, you know, the applicants have to figure out with their accountants and lawyers and whatnot, real estate professional. Qualifying census tract, again, well, we talked about that earlier. It's the same deal. In order to get the state credit, you need to be kind of in that qualifying census tract, or QCT, as we call it. And then the 30% tax credit QREs, which are qualifying rehabilitation expenses, can't exceed $2.5 million. So, I mean, probably most people aren't going around spending $2.5 million on a building that they're looking to rent for short-term rental or long-term rental or whatever. But anyhow.
That's a great, very recent addition to the program, that 30% yeah. tax credit for smaller projects.
And, you know, it certainly incentivizes further rehabilitation of buildings that wouldn't otherwise not have been viable financially. Yeah, right. That's very excellent. And then I just posted useful links. I think that can we share the presentation? Maybe we could probably do that. So I put a lot of text in here, so maybe we can share the presentation if you're interested in going through these links. You know, federal, there are federal forms. There isn't really a state form for the state credit. It's essentially when you get to federal, you can take the state. Historic rehabilitation standards, you know, the idea of making a building for a contemporary, efficient use while maintaining those aspects of a building that make it historic. That's kind of the idea of the rehabilitation standards, as opposed to something like... Well, preservation is sort of always implied you're keeping what you have, or restoration is sort of going back to an earlier period. That's not kind of a requirement of that program. It's similar to the way we think about the homeowner credit as well. And then the link at the bottom was for the state credit, which also has links to all the other information. I see. That's interesting that pops up. That's just an example. Those little... images on the side, or some of the information that Park Service has. They're kind of the central location for all kinds of information about historic buildings and treatments and stuff. Yes?
This is backtracking a little bit, but sure. Now you were talking about combining federal and state credit for commercial property.
Yeah.
Is there a federal credit for residential, you know, private residential
no.
property?
No, there
isn't. It's just state credit.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And a lot of states don't have a tax credit for homeowners at all. Or for the commercial as well. A lot of states only have, or some of them even recently within the last 10 years at one point. I'm from Rhode Island, and I know they dropped their state credit for commercial, unfortunately, and that really impacted some of the projects that were in the wings.
Doesn't that give people an incentive to move their buildings to New York?
Yeah, there's some great buildings in Rhode Island I'd love to have near me.
Yes. Does the commercial tax credit apply to residential one-family building that is rented?
Yes, it could, just income-producing properties. There are some rules. You have to look at your own finances with the IRS. It's really ultimately an IRS program, the tax credit. So, you know, there's rules about passive income. If you're just a person, you know, that's something that you'd want to look into. You'd probably, a lot of people have LLCs or whatever to could figure that out, but that's all I could possibly say about that. But there are some rules. IRS does have some of those rules about passive income where you might not be able to take a credit for something like a rental.
I have a question.
Yes.
So we have a rental, but we also live there.
Okay.
So would we have to pick which program?
You can combine them, actually. It's just divided by the percentage of what is commercial and or income producing and what is residential. And then say the exterior, which is shared by both, would be divided. You know, if 50-50, it would be divided in half.
And the advantage of that would be that you'd get a bigger credit with the commercial federal.
Right. And you in for that commercial part of your building, you couldn't take the homeowner credit for that. It would be divided out,
okay.
Essentially. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep, I've seen people combine them. It's, you know, for the homeowner credit application is pretty easy. The commercial is a bit more complicated. Let me jump back since this is kind of a very short version of talking about the commercial credit, but feel free to ask more questions when I'm done too, maybe. I didn't mention or don't have on the slide, it's sort of a three-part application. Part one is confirming essentially that your building is historic or doing some kind of write-up to evaluate the historic nature of the building. Part two is the sort of part that I review, which is the nuts and bolts of a rehabilitation project. So any plans and details of the project there, you know, we look at those very closely. Then we get everything ready and send it down to the National Park Service, who, you know, are down in D.C. They sort of have to understand the whole project from their desks. You know, we might be able to come out and do a site visit, talk to you and check it out and walk around, which is always great, you know. But we sort of help the applicant create an application that we think Park Service will understand and approve, you know. And that's kind of my task, you know. It's not always easy. I have to predict what other preservationists are going to think about a project, right? So, but that's the process. And then the part three of the application is essentially just photos of the completed work, showing that you did what you said you were going to do in the part two. And then you can take that commercial tax credit. I think there was some questions about code, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm not an architect. I think there's some architects in the room, at least one I know, met earlier in the room. I'm not an architect. I can only speak to code as I kind of see it when it has to do with historic buildings or when I come across it in the tax credit process. So, and I'll just talk a little bit about how that kind of works and may impact historic buildings. The way I guess I see it, the link at the top near codes, that's the International Code Committee. They sort of create these codes as templates for different states to adopt. And New York essentially adopts its own version of the code with some amendments as they might sort of just that work for the state. That's a whole other process. I wouldn't want to get into how that works necessarily, but that URL above is probably the best place to access the actual word of the code as adopted in New York. It sort of just allows you to read it. You have to have sort of special access to cut and paste it and stuff like that, but you can see what's actually in the code. I don't recommend reading it necessarily. it's complicated stuff. If you're not a building person necessarily, you want, you know, hire somebody who can kind of figure the stuff out if you need to. And then the stretch code is essentially, that website is from NYSERDA. It's essentially an overlay of the New York State Energy Code. And those little icons, if I can use a keyboard, I guess not. Anyway, I just picked out the names of the code that you kind of might more commonly come across in general when you're doing a rehabilitation project. I mean, the building code is really the regular building code, as I'll call it, I guess, is for new construction, sort of the highest level in a way of the code, I guess you might think of it. And then there's the residential code, which is also for new construction. the existing building code is sort of the one you kind of with an existing building, right? It's really good that New York has adopted it because it allows, you know, some flexibility with the code for existing buildings, just recognizing the sort of practical nature of how you, the things you have to deal with an existing building and the cost of rehabilitating buildings and the benefits to being able to rebuild the existing buildings. Yes.
If I can just chip in.
Sure.
The existing building code is kind of an overlay on top of the building code.
Right.
And it tells you when you're building an addition or you're doing a remodeling or you're doing an alteration, what things do you have to actually bring up to the current code and what things can you just leave the way they are?
Yep.
So you end up going to that, you end up figuring out what that is, you still end up having to pull up the building code to see.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's, you know, anything that's not referred in those other codes, you got to go back to the building code and they interact with one another.
Well, it's actually kind of the other way around. It's like if it's not referred to in the existing code,
yep,
you don't have to follow it in the building code. So that's
okay. All right, good. That's a good distinction. And then the 2020 Energy Conservation Code in New York State. So that's kind of, oh, and then the stretch code, which I kind of stretched out on the bottom there. I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, I just want to mention something about the stretch code.
Sure.
So Philmont is a municipality that has adopted the stretch code.
That's right.
And there's a significant difference between that and just being, you're exempt from the energy code if you're on the historic designation. But you are not exempt from the stretch code.
I'm going to touch base on that further.
Okay.
I think on the next slide anyway.
Okay.
Actually, the next slide after this, there's a lot of text in this one. The point of this is kind of the code for the existing building code is a process, and this is almost my notes and writing it in my own language about how you might go through the code, but the existing building code and energy code applies not just all the time, but to when you're actually doing work on a building, right? And typically, when work requires a permit. Because otherwise, who's going to know you're doing the work, I guess, right? And then the local building official is typically enforcing the code. Compliance method, there's a couple of kind of interesting pieces here. Prescriptive, classification of work and performance. So your prescriptive is kind of the word of the code, essentially. And there are some, with the existing building code, there are some provisions in there for alternatives or exemptions for any existing building, not historic, but any existing building, you know, for sprinklers and seismic retrofit, fire resistance, egress, and other parts of the code. Because the code, not the energy code, but the regular code is essentially kind of a safety code, basically. Alteration, addition, change of occupancy is covered under the prescriptive method. Those are sort of defined in the code as certain levels of work. And then that prescriptive method also includes some provisions for historic buildings in it. But the main part that talks about historic buildings is Chapter 12 of the existing building code. It has some very specific kind of alternative means of meeting the code or exemptions for historic buildings. For example, a lot of historic buildings have transoms over the windows, and that's an issue with fire code. There's a way in which you can kind of work around that with sprinklers or fire backing behind the glass. That's just sort of one example. It allows you to retain that historic piece while still keeping the building safe, essentially, you know, under the code. And so the classification of work then kind of talks about how much work you're doing, you know, how involved is it? You know, that way, if you're just repairing, then you kind of get to keep the building at the same level of protection that it currently is. Repairing is defined in the code specifically, but it's kind of, the definition is what you would normally think of as a repair, you know, fixing what you got, essentially. Alterations, level 1, 2, and 3 are, I think, defined as percentages of the amount of building that's being worked on. And so if you're at 1, you don't have to meet as much of a high level of the code, you know, and then on up through 3, change of occupancy is a whole different level of the code, because that means that potentially if you're going from, you know, a residential to a manufacturing facility, you have to have much better fire rating, you know, for example. So that kicks in another level of code. Additions in relocated buildings, I think that typically that would be, you'd have to meet the building code in that case. A new addition is essentially new construction. Moving a building usually also means you got to meet the regular building code. One of my colleagues, Bill, has an 18th century frame house, and he had it moved to his property, taken apart entirely. It's timber frame, beautiful cape. And it has one of those little skinny little stairways that go up and turn and come to either side as it goes up. And in rebuilding that house, he unfortunately couldn't keep that stairway. He had the code official just wouldn't budge on it. He had to create, you know, a regular size stairway that fit the code in that case, because he wouldn't have to if the building was in the same place and he was just rehabbing it, right? But he moved it and disassembled it, so they considered it a whole kind of new building, essentially. Then performance is calculations using specific formulas. It's math. I don't really understand it too much, but you know, people aren't typically using performance method, unless it's a bigger project and they have a more sophisticated team on hand to do that. And it also doesn't really include the energy code. I think it would be interesting if you could have a kind of a calculation for energy code. But moving on. So energy code and stretch code, in a similar way, the unaltered portions of an existing building or supply system aren't required to comply with the code, right? If you're not doing work on that part of it, you don't need to comply to those with the code. Currently, historic buildings are exempt from the energy codes. I believe that includes the stretch code as well, because the stretch code is overlaid on the energy code.
No, it does not. It's very clear. It does not.
Okay.
You're giving misinformation.
Okay.
Well, okay. That's a little misinformation also, because you can get an exemption from the stretch code, but you have to apply for it and it has to be approved.
Yeah, that's not what I said. I said you must meet the stretch code, but if you want to get an exemption, you have to do many extra steps.
Well,
right.
If
you wanted to do something that the stretch code normally would not permit, that doesn't mean that you absolutely can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, actually, first I would say we should have a conversation about that, because like the people you want to talk to are Department of State handles code, and then NYSERDA, and I could have contacts with those folks.
I've already had those conversations.
Okay.
That's why I'm telling you what I.
Okay, I had them too.
My conversations with your boss, with NYSERDA, and the Department of State. So that's
okay.
Where my information is coming from. If you have other sources, please let me know, and I'll go to them.
Okay, sounds good. Same sources, so we'll definitely figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah. Definition: historic buildings, any building that's listed in or eligible for listing in the state national registers of historic places, or that is designated as historic under an applicable state or local law. So eligible or listed buildings are exempt currently from the energy code. The bottom part of it, proposed changes in 2024 include essentially removing that exemption from the energy code. These proposed changes, they haven't happened yet, but they're, I would say, probable from what I know. And, you know, that is essentially making it more in line with the current code, where they have provisions for historic buildings. And like, for example, in IEBC, International, the existing building code, Chapter 12, that little part at the bottom, it's a little small, but it requires basically a report to be made describing exactly what historic features are going to be impacted by meeting the code, and how you can kind of, you know, that's the only way you can sort of get an exemption in that case. It requires a report to be made by a design professional or SHPO and signed off by a design professional or the state preservation office or another authority. So it's more of a process in that way. And I think actually it makes a lot of sense to me to do something like that. It's sort of still recognizing the value and need for historic buildings and existing buildings, but also obviously the obvious need to kind of make them more energy efficient, address climate change, kind of, I mean, there's a ton of reasons why you'd kind of want to improve a building in the right way and make it more energy efficient. I think having the exemption in place, in a way, it's a nice, it kind of makes it easier for rehabbing historic buildings, but a blanket exemption kind of makes it, I think, gives the impression that historic buildings are just automatically underperforming and sort of aren't valuable in that way, but in fact they are, and can be made energy efficient. I mean, even with the current exemption, when I'm reviewing projects for the tax credit, a lot of people are using NYSERDA benefits and getting the preservation tax credit for rehabilitation of very large, even like industrial buildings that are turning into residential, which aren't super easy to make energy efficient, but they're doing it to some of these higher NYSERDA standards. So it is possible, and just have to kind of, I don't know, figure it out with technology or certain interventions, achieve level of energy efficiency while retaining those features that give a historic building its character that we all love. Not all of us, but a lot of us hopefully do. You know, and recognizing, I think, some of those inherent energy efficiencies of historic buildings, relatively small size on average, except for now we're sort of building very, very small buildings. Embodied energy, which to me kind of means, well, the energy, I guess, it might cost to make all new materials, you know, and build something new, or even the energy it costs to tear down an old building. I think that's something, the existing buildings, not even necessarily historic, all have that kind of, they're already built, so you don't have to use energy to build a new one. Old school passive cooling, like solar, double hung windows, awnings, that sort of thing, or big wide porches and things like that, and built in the days before they had air conditioning. Granted, it wasn't quite as warm back then as it is now, but still, that can be useful. And I think, importantly, really, a lot of the common, you know, homeowner tax credit types of projects are pretty basic. People don't have a huge amount of money to do a passive house thing or something like that. So it's really the basics: heating, cooling system, attic roof insulation, blocking air infiltration, fixing historic windows. If you have really nice historic windows, you don't want to throw them away, you know, get storm windows and weather stripping, something like that, or get a new window that is works with the historic building. Those kind of interventions, I think, have the quickest, easiest, and have a lot of value for the money in terms of improving your house and energy efficiency. This is just some interesting language. The NPS guidance has a lot of good stuff about sustainability, about different ways to work on your house. Cultural resources and climate change strategy. I mean, that to me is really interesting because it's just the threats to cultural and historic resources from climate change, and talking about how Park Service and other organizations are obviously concerned about that. And ICOMOS is International Council of Monuments and Sites, which is, you know, kind of this idea from a more international perspective. It's really interesting kind of reading there. And that's all I have. I think there's some more slides.
One
more, just kind of with our contact information. There's some slides from, do you want to see the ones of the buildings, or
we can
or maybe I'll
leave
this up.
So, and we have cards over there as well. So we are also here to answer your questions. Now that you've heard us talk for a while, we took some questions during the presentation. But if there's more questions you have about the National Register, the proposed district, homeowner tax credit, commercial tax credit, we are here for you.
Yeah. I'm just a little confused over the 60% of the people who live in Philmont are renters. So that means you've got a lot of structures here that are being rented, and that means it's commercial. And my understanding, since I've had clients who have gone through the commercial process, that it's a whole different process from residential. So if Philmont becomes a designated district, the bulk of the buildings are going to be commercial. So we really need to understand what that commercial process is. And because of having my own clients who've gone through this, it can be very difficult. So there is something now called heritage preservation. That is when you have a negotiation between the energy code and the historic district. And an example of that would be the dormitories, the NYU dormitories, hotels to NYU dormitories, have gone that path of heritage preservation. So now Philmont doesn't have its own
right
board.
I was going to say,
how do we do that?
I would start by saying that to sort of separate a few things out there. So commercial buildings may exist in Philmont. Because they're in a district, it does not mean that the owners of those buildings have to use the tax credits. They can choose to use the tax credits. So they only are going to interact with our office if they choose to use the tax credits. That's an option. So if they choose to use a commercial tax credit, then they work with our office. We would work with them to help them achieve their goals. If they do not choose to use the tax credit, they never hear from us. So there's no obligation to work with us in any way.
But a rental is commercial.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Correct. It's income producing. But
right.
If they do not, if they can do work on their building all day long,
right.
And choose to not participate with the income producing tax credit program, and they never hear from us. So you're sort of setting up the situation where someone in New York City might be working with the Landmarks Preservation Commission, that's a local historic review board, where you have to work with them no matter what. And that's not what this is. So
no,
I want to be very clear about that so people understand.
No, I'm thinking of the Philmont situation, for instance, the hotel.
Right, they're choosing to take advantage
right.
of the historic tax credits.
Right, and it's commercial, and it's much more stringent. That process is more stringent than if it were
a rental. Yeah, that is true. The commercial tax credit takes a certain amount, takes a team of people to do, well, depending on the size of it. I mean, if I sometimes work with people who, because of the adjusted basis, if you've owned a house for 30 years, it's depreciated to not very much at all. So you have, for example, you haven't done many improvements, let's say, on it, you could have a very pretty low expenditure threshold to take the commercial tax credit, potentially. And if it doesn't always require all the engineers and architects, you know, that might be required for a bigger project. But for certainly those bigger projects, a hotel, I'm sure, is a bit of a challenge to get that tax credit.
For
sure.
Keep it simple. You just have to. It's a rental. It's commercial.
Yeah.
And I don't want to preserve the existing window because no matter what you do, it will not be standards for mechanical equipment to save energy. So I want to do a replacement.
Yeah.
Who would I discuss this with? What's available since Philmont doesn't have a board to do this. So.
Oh. I mean, I guess on the one part of it, if you needed a permit to do a window replacement, then you would just apply for that permit and do it?
No, I'm not talking about a permit. I'm talking about I want to get historic credits.
Yeah.
But I don't want to – I'm commercial.
Yeah.
And I don't want to use the existing window.
Sure.
Then you talk to Weston. He's your person.
I talk to him.
Well,
that's what I needed
he's
to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's
–
Okay.
That's correct. Yep.
And how do I talk to you? I have to prove to you that this window is historic. Do you accept heritage preservation standards or only the secretary?
I'm not really familiar with heritage preservation standards, but we go by the Secretary of the Interior standards for rehabilitation. So if you have historic windows that are in really good shape, they would need to be repaired, retained and repaired. If you have, you know, historic windows that are in bad shape and need to be replaced, then the replacement would need to be appropriate to the historic building. So, for example, a residential scale building with 2/2 windows, right? wood windows and they're in really rough shape. They got to come out. They get replaced with some, you know, a double pane insulated glass window with 2x2 in the same dimensions as the historic window, with a 3-part grid Muntin system with an inner and outer spacer bar, inner outer Muntin and a spacer bar in between the layers of insulated glass. I've said this a lot of times to people. So that's kind of an ideal replacement. It's more expensive. Hopefully that tax credit, you know, kicks in, you know, to make up for some of that extra expense.
I'm just bringing this up because the bulk of the buildings in Philmont would be commercial.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point.
Okay.
For sure.
And is the material, does it have to be the same material as the window that came out?
So, yeah, the material is important. It should be wood. And we do sometimes accept aluminum clad wood because in reason why aluminum is just that manufacturers are making a better match for historical windows in those aluminum clad wood windows.
I hate to get so detailed, but
yeah, that's right.
A vinyl window and you want to replace that window, can that window be replaced with vinyl?
And not for the commercial credit, should be replaced with something that is sort of more appropriate to a historic building.
But for the homeowner credit.
Homeowner is a little different.
Yeah. So for the homeowner credit, if you have a vinyl window in there, in most circumstances, and all the ones I can think of, will allow you to put a vinyl in there.
Yeah, there were a few hints before, and I know we're getting into the weeds, so I want to make sure that we're getting everybody. Yeah.
If you're dealing with a historic building that has been vacant and neglected for an extended period of time and has significant structural damage in the roof and interior floors, is there some criteria, is there some like percentage of the building that has to be kept intact in order for it to qualify? Like if one half of the building
is so the basic qualification to be able to take advantage of the programs is for the building to be designated as contributing to the historic district in the documentation for the nomination. That's all still under development. But the majority of buildings in any district are contributing. And I would say, so you probably all know that there's a lot of buildings in Newburgh that are in rough shape. There's a massive historic district there that was listed back in the 80s. And I get projects in for buildings that were called contributing, and it might be three walls and part of a roof. And if it got called contributing in the 80s and somebody wants to do a project on it now, they want to take that on, we send them on. We let them go for it. So sometimes a building is sort of a shell, and if somebody wants to invest in it and use the program, great. And I mean, you sort of work with the building you have, as both of them said. So whatever the existing condition of the building, you start there. Nobody's forcing you to restore it to anything.
It's not so much the amount of like original material as it is that you're going to restore it to what's
exactly
appropriate.
As long as that building was designated as contributing to the historic district, then you sort of have this pathway you can choose to take advantage of.
I guess my question is, does it have to like replicate the existing building?
The tax credits aren't restoration programs. They're rehabilitation programs. So, which basically just means keep a building in service.
So before we finish, Rebecca, which is really coming on the end of what we're talking about, can you tell the audience and the attendees where we are in the process, right, so that they understand where we are, what the nomination process is,
and that the nomination right now is being written by Jesse, and that all of those 425 resources are going through more detailed to find
right
if they are eligible to contribute.
Exactly. So the final documentation isn't ready. When we get to that point,
we'll have a map, we'll have all the stuff. Jesse did the survey, we determined the district is eligible, and I understand the plan is to have all of that documentation ready for later this year. I believe the plan is December.
End of October
finished. Exactly. So there would be another meeting potentially in November, and at that time we would have a map showing which buildings are contributing and which buildings are non-historic, non-contributing. And that would be sort of the final point. If you wanted to send in a letter of objection or a letter of support, that's sort of when this all comes to an end. We're still sort of in the process of pulling that information together. And that would be in early December of this year.
So, yeah, I had that exact question. I'm in the process of getting solar panels. I've already signed the contract and whatnot. So it doesn't look like it will be designated for 2024.
So actually, I will say, yeah, if you are... So this is one of these situations where we don't have a district yet, right? District really has to be listed on the state register for you to take advantage of the homeowner tax credit. There are cases like now, this is moving along. We expect this to go to a state review board. You could put in a homeowner tax credit application for a building in the district right now. That would come to me and I would sort of do a preliminary confirmation that yes, your building is contributing. You can get that in. If the district moves forward down the road, you could close out that application. If the district does not move, you know, after the listing happens, if the district does not move forward, then of course there's no tax credit.
But if my project's complete and we're not designated yet,
you can't submit the Part 3.
But can I submit it when we are, like if it's a year?
Exactly. So if anyone was interested in using the homeowner tax credit, if there's something you're thinking about for this year, absolutely grab my card, Molly's card. Happy to talk to you about it. You can put in an application. There's no reason you can't.
And this is above and beyond the energy.
Right. Well, we've done it before, and you could certainly talk to us and explore whether it's worth doing. You just can't get the credit unless the district actually gets listed. But we do accept homeowner tax credit projects in these situations. So let me get this gentleman back there. You.
As noted, more than 50% of the structures here are rental units.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those units have anywhere from one tenant, but often two, three, or four, or more, or six tenants. Separate little units that have been carved out of a house, often a 19th century one that was a single family house. And this whole scheme of things, because this town really qualifies because of the low income of many of the inhabitants. What's in this whole thing for the tenant? I guess that's my first question. And the other is, okay, so the owner of the property let me know that more than 30 properties are owned by just a couple of landlords who are absentee. And you can see most of those buildings around here because they're noted for their shabbiness, if not derelict status. So the landlord goes ahead, gets all the tax credits, fixes things up, etc., and then converts it to a one family. So before they would have had perhaps three or four families living there, now it's a one-family house.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't claw back any of the credits or anything like that.
The use of the building is sort of unrelated to how the credit is managed. It is a fair point.
We wouldn't claw it back or anything like that. The preservation tax credit doesn't really kind of speak to that. That's obviously an important point, but it really doesn't because, I mean, you could rehab it and create 30 apartments, so you could rehab it and create a single family. To be honest, our program wouldn't really speak to that. It'd be something more like you'd want to kind of work with probably some kind of local ordinance or something like that.
There are lots of districts across the state that have, you know, high tenant populations, and the way that we deal with notifications and codes, it's all about the owners. That's the way that the regulations are written. So I've worked in New York City for years, and I get people sending me letters of support for a district, but they're not an owner, you know. They just live there. They're part of the community. And so I get at that point.
That's not the way that the program is designed to specifically deal with the needs of tenants. However, that is where you, as the community, as the village, that's where you can have some power over what's going on in your community at the local level.
But essentially, as you envision it, you will give the credits as long as it meets a SMART
right
criteria.
If they meet the basic
right.
standards of
but
the program.
What's
yeah.
going on inside the building, they could completely gut the entire building as long as the exterior is authentic.
That's not true.
For the commercial credit especially, the interior is considered just as much as the exterior.
So if the building had four units and four kitchens, and they decided to turn the building into one family, they'd have to keep the other three kitchens.
If all of that stuff was historic, and probably the kitchen equipment itself, what isn't going to be historic, it would be more the room divisions, but you said gutting, so no, you can't do that. But the actual use inside the house, wouldn't be so concerned with the use as long as it conforms with the historic nature of the building, right? It doesn't remove all the historic material that's in there, essentially. Yeah. And that might make it a little more challenging, I guess, if you had a building that was kind of totally intact as a multifamily and you were trying to turn it into one somehow. Yeah.
It's not a silver bullet program. Unfortunately, not going to fix everything.
You had your hand up for a little while, and I'll be back down, so I don't know.
I already know.
Forgot. I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm a historic building. It's on the National Register. Also, using tax credits for several years. You may have discussed this, but there are old photographs of our house from the 1800s with a picket fence very close to the front of the house. I would like to put another picket fence with that qualify.
No, I don't think it would, right, because it's landscape.
It depends on
what program are you talking about.
Homeowner versus commercial.
I'm sorry, what program?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, but either one, it wouldn't count.
Well,
I guess. Because it's a landscape feature, separate, not attached to the house, you couldn't take the tax credits for that one particular part of the project.
But you can still do it.
Well, yeah.
Is there another program where it could be taking tax credits?
Not that I know of. No. No. Sorry.
In the back corner.
Right. That part of the house.
What's that? For a homeowner.
For homeowner, any detached garage will not count. If it is physically attached to the house itself, we can cover that. For commercial.
Yeah, commercial it could potentially. You could include that in your qualifying rehab expenses for the commercial. Yeah.
This is why they're both here.
I just, a similar thing. I perked up when I heard you talk about drainage. I had a situation where the hill now is like 5 feet from the back porch is going down, and I need to get a retainer wall, and I put it off for years because it's just something that's not a fun and expensive thing, but it really is part of, like, I'm concerned about the house. I know a big tree is probably going to go down with this hill if the hill goes down. Would they consider that, or is that landscape?
For the homeowner, we would definitely consider it. I would say contact. So Frances Stern is actually going to be the reviewer for this historic district. She wasn't able to make it tonight. You can always talk to any one of us, though. We should be able to help you. It really does depend on the situation in the house. So, again, if it's purely landscape, it's just going to be retaining from the land. That's different. But if it's, if you can see, you know, damage is going to be incurred to this house because of, if there is no retaining wall there, this house is going to be damaged. That's something we would consider.
Basically, it can't hurt to ask.
Right. It can never hurt to ask.
If you were digging around foundation to get to repoint the foundation, right, clearly
yeah.
that would count
yeah.
because that's all that. Well, different situation,
yeah.
but example.
Is,
right, well, there's definitely drainage.
Yeah, and the outbuilding question reminds me. So, while outbuildings are covered by the homeowner tax credit, depending on the nature of your outbuilding, there is a barn tax credit, and I understand
that carriage houses count under that. So that may apply to some buildings here. That's a 25% tax credit. That's a separate thing. If somebody's interested in that, grab a card. You can email any of us and ask about that, and we can get you the information.
Do you know what year it is? Is there a certain era that has to be used? I know the Dutch one.
I think it's 1946.
Yeah, I was going to say, older than 1946. You guys have a lot of good questions.
Oh, one question about more than 50% have to agree, people in the,
correct,
in the district. So we have to compile signatures of the homeowners?
So, no. When you're doing a district, it's very important to do things like this.
Yeah.
Outreach. Make sure that the community understands what's going on, that they're interested, sort of get see what questions and concerns are in advance, sort of as part of the process. Because when I have worked with some districts where the first time they hear about this happening is when they receive the letter from our office a month or a couple months before the meeting, sometimes it doesn't go well. People don't like to be surprised. When it comes to the final process, when the district nomination is done, we send out our letter. That's when property owners can send us a letter of objection or support. In the regulations, it's objections that are what really count. So it's if a greater than 50% of the property owners object, then the district would not go forward.
But they have to send you something.
Right. It's a notarized letter, or it has to have a specific language. The in, all of that is in our letters, so people have the information that they need. So I didn't write the law or the regulations, but it's if you don't say anything to us, it counts as a yes. If we hear from you, then we're counting no's. And if we start getting a lot of letters in any district, we start putting the brakes on before we hit 50% and say, what's going on here? We need to talk because we're not, you know, we come to communities that express interest and ask us to come.
But you
we don't
want letters of support. Also.
Well, yes, letters of support are great. They're always great. But what we have to count are the objections. And we don't want to, we're not here to do anything to anybody. We're coming to communities that ask us to come to them.
So each property owner has a voice.
Correct.
They can send you a letter.
Correct.
And they have a vote then?
That's basically the vote, is the letter that we ask to send.
I'm thinking of the cases where we have structures that are owned by LLCs, absentee landlords.
An LLC would be counted as one. Husband and wife owning a house together each have one. One person who owns six houses has one. That's how it's counted. It's not by property or by acreage. It's by ownership entity. So if there's one person and they have an LLC for every house, well, you know, that's how it is. But if it's one person that owns six houses, it's one.
So an LLC for each house is a separate business.
Correct.
You can't get
it's
a separate
ownership site. Entity person.
Trust.
Right.
Trust.
Exactly. But a husband and wife owning one house together, they each get a vote. They can vote opposite each other if they want. I'm just here counting. So.
What is it? This vote. What is the vote?
That would be in.
Back, yeah.
Yep. Going back to the process.
No,
so.
Going back to so the nomination went open at Jesse Lavin, who wrote the survey. We'll finish the nomination.
In the fall.
Well, end of August.
Mm-hmm, right.
And we go through the process where we have this village will hold a public meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It's advertised.
You would receive, so if this goes to the December State Review Board, which is what we're talking about right now, you would receive a letter from our office in October. That October letter would include information about, you know, if you wanted to send us a letter, of support or objection. It would include the date of a public meeting in November here in the community, one last opportunity to talk about this. And we would want any letters of support or objection by the date of the December meeting. I believe it's the 8th of December. I think that date got moved on me, but that's what's sticking in my mind. So it's early December, and you'll certainly be continuing to hear from the folks here locally, and certainly from us as we get closer.
So everybody understands this, the calendar moves with this process. So if Jesse Ravitch doesn't make the finish of the nomination at the end, we just move another quarter.
Right.
And so the whole thing just moves another quarter, meaning we would submit in January rather than...
Exactly.
December.
We have quarterly meetings March, June, September, and December.
The
so.
That we send out, mm-hmm. we hope that some people read them. We think they do. And we try to give that information so it's like, okay, I'm getting it.
Right.
So we will try our best.
You said community, but you really mean the historic district. It's just the people within the district that you have to have 50%.
Correct, within the boundary. In this case,
right.
The district is pretty basically the entire community. Yeah. Yes.
You said you're going to mail out the letter forms or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We all have post office boxes here, but I'm sure you got the street address.
Well,
you're going to overwhelm the post office, and they got to put that all aside. If they really don't know an individual, they got to look those numbers up.
When the... So it's the responsibility of the sponsor and the consultant to pull together the mailing addresses for all of the property owners in the community. And I'm sure that, you know, you go to the tax records, you get that information, they should have the PO boxes. So we're not going to be sending letters to addresses and incorrect information. We think it's very important to have that, and I know that your local folks will be on it.
So, Monty... The mailing list that we're working right now and we'll be reviewing it over and over again is going to be...
I've been working on this for a couple of years, working with both the people who do the codes, get that in the trust code, because it's very difficult to go in. So it's a struggle.
It went in the NYSERDA overlay.
Sorry?
It's in the NYSERDA overlay, you're saying? The stretch code.
No, it is just fully in the code. NYSERDA doesn't play a role in the code. This is purely on the code.
But that's in the, you're talking about the stretch code?
Yeah.
I will go back to my Christopher Scroy, I think is his last name.
Oh, yes. Yes, nice to meet you. Based on a name.
Right.
I know.
I'll
ask
him again.
County person.
Okay.
I totally believe you.
I
think I have it.